Hi, everyone, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me to speak. I'm going to give three lectures on observational cosmology. And there's a separate set of theoretical cosmology lectures next week. But I'm going to start by just summarizing some theory, just to kind of set the stage for the observational stuff I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to just present a few slides on the standard cosmological model. So you probably know that in cosmology, we have a standard model. It's a really remarkable fact that so far as we know, all cosmological data taken to date can be fit by this model with six parameters. Let me just go through the parameters. The first parameter is the cosmological constant. And since this is a talk for particle physics, I quoted it as an energy density in GeV to the fourth. Next is the fraction of matter today, which is in baryonic matter. And I'm using the cosmologist terminology that an electron is part of the baryonic matter. So that's this 5% in the pie chart that's in every plot. The next parameter is the fraction of matter today that's in cold dark matter. The next two parameters are setting the amplitude and spectral tilt of the initial conditions. I'll talk more about those shortly. And the sixth parameter is the nuisance parameter, the CMB optical depth, or the probability that a CMB photon observed today has scattered off a free electron in the universe since it was emitted at last scattering. The standard model can be summarized more or less by the following sequence of bullet point statements that I'll go through one at a time. So first off, the background metric is FRW. You guys, I'm not going to assume that the audience has taken a cosmology class before, so I'll try to make this self-contained. And I'm not even going to use GR in a serious way. But I will do things like write down the metric. So the FRW metric looks like this. It says that you just multiply the space-space part of the Minkowski metric by a function A of t. That function A of t, the scale factor, fully describes the expansion of the universe. And it just means that lengths were smaller earlier in the universe's history by a factor of A. So if we wind the clock back to when A is a third, the universe is one third of its present size. To describe the evolution of the scale factor in more detail, let me start by just saying how the energy densities evolve. So the energy density of dark energy, by assumption, I'm assuming it's a cosmological constant in the standard model, is constant. The energy density of non-relativistic matter scales as the scale factor to the -3. And that makes sense because if non-relativistic matter gets its energy density from rest masses of particles. So if I change all lengths by a factor of A, leaving the rest masses unchanged, and the energy density goes up by A cubed. Radiation or relativistic matter, like photons and neutrinos, have an energy density that scales as A to the -4, with an additional factor of 1 over A because of the redshift effect. As I wind the clock back, the energies are going up by a factor of A. So if I were to just take this form of the scale factor A of t for granted and wind the clock back to previous points in the universe's history when A was the third or 10 to the -4 respectively, then the energy budget in the pie chart would change. The dark energy goes away. Eventually, if I wind the clock back very far, then radiation takes over as the dominant form of stress energy in the universe. And then finally, if you know how the energy densities evolve as a function of the scale factor, then to get this curve, the scale factor as a function of time, you just integrate Friedman's equation, which is one of Einstein's equations specialized to the FRW metric, that relates the Hubble parameter. I forgot to say that the derivative of log A with respect to time, the fractional rate of change of the scale factor, is called the Hubble parameter. I think I used the capital H in some of the subsequent slides. Anyway, that expansion rate is proportional to the square root of the total energy density. So if you know how the energy density scales as a function of A, you can integrate to get A as a function of time. And you can see here, if you look very closely at this plot, it's not super prominent on this log-log scale, but behavior of A of t is switching over as the universe progresses from being radiation-dominated to matter-dominated to dominated by a cosmological constant. The energy densities grow as t to the 1/2, t to the 1/3, and finally you're switching to an exponential phase of expansion, assuming that lambda is the right story. All right, so that describes the first three parameters on the list. they fully parameterize the expansion history or the behavior of the background. Now, so far, I haven't talked about perturbations. I've been describing the universe as if it's spatially homogeneous. Of course, there are perturbations that grow over time and gravitationally collapse. That's why, like, a galaxy is a perturbation. The next two parameters on the list are specifying the statistics of the perturbations in the initial conditions. So the initial conditions and the standard cosmological model are described as follows. To start with the initial perturbations in the metric, I'll introduce a function zeta, which is a function of space but not time. The metric in a particular gauge can be written in a form where the initial perturbation just shows up as this term e to the 2 zeta. Zeta is small, so I could have just as well written 1 plus 2 zeta, which is just spatially perturbing the space-based parts of the metric. So this field zeta is going to fully specify the initial perturbation. It's called the adiabatic curvature, or sometimes the initial curvature. It's a random field. In cosmology, the standard model of cosmology is a probabilistic theory. We can't predict the specific realization of zeta that will occur in the initial conditions, but we can answer probabilistic questions, like what's the probability of zeta having a certain value in a certain place? Or given the assumption that zeta has a certain value in a certain place, what's the probability that it has a different value in a different place, the conditional probability? So the statistics of this random field are described by the following statements that I will define more precisely today. So this is, I'm going to just sort of roughly state them. Saying that the initial perturbations are self-similar. There's no preferred scale in this plot. Secondly, it's almost scale invariant, which is a stronger statement than self-similar. Defining scale invariant to mean that if I were, this picture would be scale invariant if it had the property that if I took a small subregion and magnified it to have the size of the original box, that it would be statistically indistinguishable from the original. That is almost but not quite true. What is true is that if I take a small box and magnify it, then what I get is statistically indistinguishable from the original except for a constant prefactor. The amplitude looks a little different. If you zoom in on different scales, you get a different overall amplitude. The observations show that the long wavelength modes have slightly, but not exactly, the same amplitude as the short wavelength modes in the picture.
So would self-similar be the same statement is that amplitude thing the difference between self-similar and scale invariant?
This, by the way, is my pet terminology. It's just to let everyone know. The distinction that I'm drawing between self-similar and scale invariant is that self-similar means that the power spectrum of the field is a power law. And scale invariant would mean that the exponent here were zero. Finally, the initial perturbations have a characteristic size, which is observed to be very small. This is essentially the amplitude of temperature fluctuations in the CMB relative to the mean CMB temperature, something like 5 times 10 to the minus 5. So a bit more formally, these bullet points were informally informally summarizing the statements that zeta is a Gaussian random field, which is something I'm going to define precisely in a few slides, with this power law, power spectrum, with some free parameters, which are the square of the size of the characteristic size of the fluctuations, and the spectral index, which is defined in such a way that a value of 1 would correspond to the scale invariant case. And the observed value, which is a little bit less than 1, means that the perturbations are slightly larger on small scales than they are on small scales.
You did small scales before and after the then. They're smaller on large scales.
Larger amplitude. I think I said it wrong. Larger amplitude on large scales, smaller amplitude on small scales. Thanks. Finally, so far I've only specified the perturbations in the metric, the initial perturbations are scalar adiabatic, which is a more technical statement. The scalar adjective means that all components of the metric, or all perturbations of the metric, are fully described by this function zeta. In particular, there's no gravity wave or transverse traceless piece, hij, in the metric. At least as far as we know from the observations, as you probably know, some but not all models of inflation predict that there should be primordial gravity waves. Whether or not there are, in most models of inflation, the question of whether or not there are gravity waves is related to the question of whether inflation happened at the gut scale. So this is one of the error bars on these on a traceless transverse gravity wave-like perturbation to the metric are something that should improve a lot in the next few years. And this is one of the more exciting things that's coming up in observational cosmology. There was a famous retracted detection of this piece that happened a few years ago, as I'm sure everyone knows. And then finally, the statement adiabatic is more technical. It means that the zeta field, in addition to fully parameterizing the perturbations in the metric, also completely determines the perturbation in the stress energy tensor. In the stress energy tensor of all particle species, by a universal set of rules, there's the so-called adiabatic mode, which relates all perturbations in stress energy to the perturbations in the metric. I'll try to talk more about where this comes from later. Okay, so these next two numbers are specifying the statistics of the perturbations, of the initial perturbations in the standard model. And then the last parameter is a nuisance parameter that unfortunately we need to talk about, which is an astrophysical nuisance parameter. And in order to make sense out of this parameter, I need to tell you that the thermal history of electrons in the universe looks roughly as follows. At early times, before a redshift of around 1,000, which is where this, or a scale factor of 10 to the minus 3, which is where the CMB forms, the universe is an opaque plasma. The electrons are ionized. The ionization fraction of the universe is close to 1. As the universe cools, the temperature of the plasma gets much smaller than the binding energy of a hydrogen atom, and the universe becomes transparent. And there's a long period in the evolution of the universe where the universe is cooling well below the hydrogen binding energy, and all of the electrons are bound up in neutral hydrogen or helium. Until something astrophysical happens at a mean redshift of around 7, it starts happening earlier. Stars and quasars, compact sources of UV photons, form. And those UV photons can ionize hydrogen, helium and hydrogen, and become ubiquitous enough that the ionization fraction goes back to nearly 1. Most hydrogen and most electrons in the universe today are ionized. A CMB photon is emitted, somewhere in this transition, and it free streams through the neutral universe until it encounters free electrons in the late universe. And then it has some probability of Thomson scattering before it's observed. And tau is just the probability that that happened. So that the observed value of tau is around 0.06, which means that if we observe a CMB photon today, there's a 94% chance that it came directly from the surface of last scattering from CMB formation, and a 6% chance that it Thomson scattered off a free electron before we observed it. This is actually, you might wonder, who cares about tau? And indeed, pinning tau down to another decimal place would not really be of direct interest. It turns out to be an extremely important astrophysical nuisance parameter because of accidental degeneracies in the CMB with other parameters. For reasons that I hope to explain, the effect of tau on the CMB power spectrum is very similar to, say, the effect of varying the neutrino mass. So that the limiting factor in measuring, I think it is likely that the limiting factor in constraining neutrino mass from cosmology in the near future will be residual uncertainty on tau. Whole experiments are proposed, like CMB satellites are proposed in cosmology with lowering the error bar on tau being one of the main science cases. I've personally written, two papers trying to think of different ways to pin down tau from cosmological observables. It's actually kind of an important problem that observational cosmologists think about, how to get rid of this degeneracy.
Is it mostly related to exactly when the ionization happened, or is it?
Oh, it is, yeah. I mean, strictly speaking, it's an integral over this whole history. But more or less, it's this transition is pretty sharp. So more or less, it's the mean redshift inefficient. Okay, so summarizing, I've now explained all the parameters in the standard cosmological model. You might notice that most of these parameters are determined to a few percent. So cosmology is a precision science in 2018. We understand the universe to a few percent, and we're trying to understand whether we understand it to 0.1% or whether we have to change the model. So the standard cosmological model just makes statements about, just describes the mean evolution of the universe and the perturbations in the initial conditions at very early times. And those initial conditions are super simple. They're just a Gaussian random field with a featureless power spectrum. So as time evolves, the perturbations become more complex. So I didn't bother including a plot of the power spectrum of zeta because plotting a power law is not very interesting. But by the time we get to a redshift of 1100, that power law power spectrum has been processed by a lot of complicated physics, by this evolution of acoustic waves in a plasma, to produce this CMB power spectrum with a lot of structure and a lot of information contained in it. If I were to change a cosmological parameter, like the dark energy density, that would make no difference in the power spectrum of the initial conditions, but it would change this power spectrum. That's why the CMB can constrain dark energy. So this means that another point that I want to emphasize about this arrow is that all of the physics is linear. Every pixel of the CMB map, the temperature in every pixel, is a complicated but linear function of the pixels of the zeta map. And that's just true because the perturbations are small. They haven't grown gravitationally yet, or haven't grown much. So just truncating the nonlinear physics at linear order is a good approximation. So the reason that the CMB is so powerful is, first off, because this plot can be measured to great precision, but also because it can be predicted with great precision. There's some just linear transfer function that you can compute that directly relates what you measure to the cosmological parameters and the statistics of the initial conditions. And that becomes harder and harder the later you go in the universe's evolution as nonlinear effects and messy astrophysical stuff like star formation kicks in. If we go to late times, we have very complicated nonlinear observables, like, say, the distribution of galaxies or the spatial power spectrum of galaxies, where nonlinear effects in astrophysics are important, and the perturbations now are very non-Gaussian. And then finally, I could put another arrow on this plot, which is trying to explain where zeta came from. And there are models of the early universe, inflation, or other things like the cyclic universe, that try to start with nothing or an unperturbed universe and produce zeta fluctuations quantum mechanically that match the observed initial conditions. In each of these three stages, different physics is important. So I'm not sure what Raphael plans to cover in his theoretical cosmology lectures, but each of these three arrows can kind of be like an independent mini class. When I teach the three-week cosmology class here in the Perimeter Master's program, I usually just pick one of the three arrows and make a mini class out of it. If you're talking about the early universe, then the physics which is important is quantum mechanics and an expanding space-time. Formation of the CMB, the physics that is important is linear perturbation theory in a plasma with many components. There are many different particle species that are important, and you also have to keep track of phase space distributions, so you end up with a very complicated set of differential equations with many degrees of freedom, but the equations are all linear and can be integrated very exactly. At late times, the relevant physics is gravitational n-body physics, which has fewer degrees of freedom than the CMB, but is nonlinear and very messy. And also astrophysics comes in, which is extremely messy and in practice involves introducing a bunch of free nuisance parameters to capture things like how many stars form in the average galaxy or how much cosmic ray pressure they produce. That's where we stand in 2018. The challenge for observers going forward is to continue to understand the standard model has evolved through a long sequence of historical surprises. And the challenge for observers is to continue to understand which model fits the data and whether we'll find more surprises and need to introduce more parameters. I put sort of a list of milestones in the field. And just looking at this list, you could see that these must have been, you know, these things must have been really profound discoveries when they were made. So much of our information about new physics, say beyond the particle physics standard model, comes from cosmology, things like the existence of dark matter or the cosmological constant. The last time the model was changed was in 2006, which is recent enough that I was doing cosmology then, when the parameter NS was added. Prior to this, the observations were consistent with a scale invariant power spectrum, NS equals 1. And so the observation of deviation from scale invariance having more power on large scales is actually really interesting and important for models of the early universe. It's related to the breaking of time translation symmetry in the early universe. If the physics of inflation, say, were perfectly time translation invariant, nothing was evolving, then you would expect to see a perfectly scale invariant power spectrum. So this this observation is informing. Of course, you expect inflation not to be perfectly time translation invariant because at some point it has to end. But this observation is very informative in pinning down, you know, the details of how that deviation from that breaking of time translation symmetry happens.
You didn't put dark matter in the 1930s, so you don't count as lucky.
Oh yeah, some of these dates actually involve some subjectivity. I don't actually know. I think I guess you'd have to really be a historian to settle the question. But it's my understanding that if dark matter was not a mainstream theory, and if you ask like the average astronomer, 1970 is roughly the time when they would have become convinced. But I'm not sure. The history is actually much messier than this. Like there were papers, well, like I'm crediting the supernova experiments with discovering the cosmological constant, because those historically seem to be the observations that convince people. But if you look at the literature, the history is much more complicated and messier. Like there were papers a few years before this arguing that because of the abundance of galaxy clusters at low redshifts, matter-dominated expansion couldn't fit the data. And I think the conclusion of those papers was that you had to have either a cosmological constant or curvature. I don't think they could distinguish. And likewise, the deviation from scale invariance was really hinted at before 2006. There were, you know, papers that combined a bunch of different data sets and got a 2-sigma deviation or maybe a 2.x sigma deviation. But it was really the 3-year WMAP papers that really got a high significance detection and really convinced everyone. Should be kept in mind that this is a model which has emerged from a sequence of historical surprises, and those may not be finished yet, so I like to think of it as under construction. And then the challenge for a theorist is to just explain all the weird stuff that's come out of this at a fundamental level. We know that dark matter has to exist, but not how it's related to other particles, or physics beyond the standard model. The cosmological constant, it's easy to see that there's the cosmological constant makes sense as a free parameter in the theory of gravity, hard to understand why it would be fine-tuned, so something on the order of 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. Finally, what physics is responsible for quantum mechanically generating the initial fluctuations is a super interesting question. We have enough statistical power in the CMB and other observables to constrain these cosmological parameters, to constrain them all jointly, although there are some large correlations, as you can see in this plot, to constrain extensions of the standard model, I'll just skip this slide, which is mostly what we're really concerned with. I think that if we knew that the 6-parameter standard model was going to, if we somehow knew in advance that it was going to fit the data forever, then it would be of little interest to shrink error bars on parameters like the fraction of dark matter in the universe today. What we're really trying to do is improve statistical errors and figure out whether we need to extend the standard model, for example, by adding one of these ingredients. Observational cosmology is, you know, trying to do is first understand how to analyze data better. You might think that observational cosmology is a mature subject and that if I gave you in advance the data from the maps from a CMB experiment 10 years in the future, that it would be sort of a mechanical crank-turning process to figure out how to analyze those maps and get cosmological parameters. But that is actually not true at all. The field moves very quickly, and the statistical machinery is always just like maybe a couple of years or even with the experiments. Basic questions like how to optimally extract statistically the CMB lensing signal from future data sets are still open questions that are being actively studied. So a lot of what observational cosmologists are doing is thinking about the statistical machinery and trying to improve it. And then the other major front, I think, is trying to understand whether we've parameterized every possible surprise. Is this list complete, or are there interesting physically motivated parameters that we should add to the list? This list as written is not complete. I just stopped after I listed six. There's, of course, way more. If you go through the literature, way more extensions of the standard model that people are interested in. So for the rest of today, I'm going to talk about random variables and fields. I'm just going to introduce some statistical machinery. Let me start by saying that at a summer school, I think people have like a huge range of different backgrounds. Some of you are theorists, and I think maybe one of you is an experimenter. you might be a different... You might be at different point, have taken different classes, have different backgrounds. I decided to assume from the point of view of giving these lectures that everyone in the audience is at an early stage in their research career. Like, let's say you're in the middle of a master's and thinking about what to do for a PhD. I find that observational cosmology it's a really interesting active subject, but it gets a little underemphasized in classes. On the archive, maybe if you look at papers written by cosmologists, maybe half of those papers are theorists that are computing Feynman diagrams, and half of the papers are observational cosmologists that are doing things like making forecasts for new experiments or inventing new statistics, analyzing data. I personally kind of stumbled. That's what I do. And I personally kind of stumbled into it by accident. I started out as more of a theoretical cosmologist, and then I started reading these papers and getting interested in it. So I'm going to take the perspective that observational cosmology is something that you know is interesting, but haven't had much background in. And I'm going to try to convince you that this is an interesting thing to do with your life, and I'm going to evangelize a little bit. I want to try to give a sense for, at like a nuts and bolts level, how we as observational cosmologists spend our time. So I'm going to actually make the lectures a little bit technical and talk about the details of some of the machinery that we use. I want to start by just talking about machinery for random variables and fields. I'm actually going to go back to basics and just talk about like probability distributions in one variable, n variables, and so on, because experience has shown that that's a useful way to build up abstractions like Gaussian random fields. Also, if you do it in slides, then you can just flash through it really fast, so it's easy to review things. Let me just say that the standard model of cosmology is a probabilistic model. We do not predict a specific CMB realization on the sky, but we can predict probability of occurrence of a particular realization. So you might be wondering, if I give you a CMB realization, some pattern of pixel values, how to compute its probability of occurrence? I'm going to start by doing about 10 minutes of review of statistics, concentrating on the parts that are important for understanding random fields in cosmology. So a physicist's definition of a random variable, let me just start with a random variable in one dimension, is anything with a probability distribution function p of x, and that always means probability per unit x. For this arbitrarily chosen example, if I draw random samples from this PDF, the histogram matches the PDF. If I wanted to compute the probability of a random sample being in a particular range, I would integrate the PDF, and to calculate the expectation value of a random variable, I just integrate the PDF times whatever I want to take the expectation value of. New random variables can be constructed from old ones for in this one-dimensional context. I could define a random variable y by drawing two random x's and adding them together. And that probability distribution would have some PDF that I've just computed in simulation here. And if I keep doing this with 3, 4, and so on, then I can see the PDF of the sum of a bunch of independent x's converging to the Gaussian bell curve. As I've iterated this plot, I'm rescaling the axis here by root n. The width is actually increasing. So that by the time I get to, I'm adding 20 of these together, it Gaussianizes pretty fast. Even with n equals 4 or 5, it's looking pretty Gaussian. And after I get to n equals 20, this distribution is visually indistinguishable from the Gaussian PDF with this functional form. So let me explain a little bit where this comes from, including the 20s and the pi's. So the central limit theorem, Gaussian random variables are everywhere in experimental subjects. For example, the noise in any sort of detector is likely to be well described by a Gaussian process. And usually the reason that that is good approximation is that the central limit theorem somehow applies. So to state the central limit theorem formally, it says that the sum of a large number of independent, identically distributed, both of these hypotheses, the independence and the identical distribution, are important. Random variables has a PDF which is approximately Gaussian. And I won't try to prove it in the slides, but this is one way of motivating this functional form for the Gaussian PDF, is to go through the proof of the central limit theorem. And this functional form will just emerge in the course of the proof. And so this has two parameters, a mean and a variance, or a width, sigma. The variance is sigma squared. And so if I want to match, say, the 20 in the pi, the 20 in this expression, then if I know that a PDF is Gaussian, then I just need to compute its variance. I forgot to say what the mean and the variance were. The mean is just another name for the expectation value. And the variance, it's actually kind of helpful to remember that there's two ways of computing it. You can either take the expectation value of the square minus the square of the expectation value, or you can take the expectation value of the square of the deviation from the mean. The variance is interpreted as the squared size of typical fluctuations around the mean. For the Gaussian, as the notation suggests, if I take this functional form for the PDF, the mean is the parameter x bar appearing in the PDF, and the variance is the parameter sigma squared. So for this PDF considered previously, the mean is 0 and the variance is 1/2. If I take n of these x's and add them together, as I was doing in these plots, I'll just skip the algebra because it's straightforward to see that if I add n random variables together, both the mean and the variance are additive when I add together independent things, so that the mean and variance could just go up by a factor of n. So in all of these histograms, the mean is always 0, and the variance is always n times 1/2. So one point that I am trying to convey in the plots is that, in general, the mean and the variance don't determine the PDF. There's some shape which is not captured by those two numbers. But for a Gaussian, they do. So for if n is large, then the mean is 0 and the variance is n over 2. And you also know by the central limit theorem that the PDF is expected to be Gaussian. So from those statements, you can deduce that the PDF should have this functional form. So that's what's going on in one dimension. Multivariate random variables as the next step in toward talking about random fields. We could talk about an n-component random variable, which are not assumed independent. So the PDF might be some function of n variables, which is probability per unit n volume. For example, a Gaussian PDF might have a correlation between the two variables, and might have this shape where, with level contours being ellipses. I'll write down the PDF precisely for a multivariate Gaussian in a few slides. So here's an example which is similar of Gaussianization in multiple variables, which is similar to the 1D example that I showed before. So here in this slide, I've just made up a PDF in two variables. And to make it extremely non-Gaussian, I took the PDF to be a delta function so that the PDF is concentrated on this circle of radius 1. The little wiggles and color variations in this plot are just plotting artifacts. In this two-variable example, a random x is a two-component vector. And as in the one-variable case, I can start adding x's together. So if I make a y by taking two x's, which are two-component vectors, and adding those two vectors, then I get that is a random variable with some interesting probability distribution. Here's what happens if I add three together, five, so on. And as in the one variable case, the central limit theorem has taken over and made the PDF in this two variable example into a multivariate Gaussian. It's easy to see that in this two variable case, the multivariate Gaussian is going to have five parameters, two means, and then three parameters describing the width of the ellipse along its two axes and the orientation. So to formalize that, in n variables, the mean would be an n component vector, and the variance would be an n by n covariance matrix. So that's a symmetric n by n matrix with whose diagonal elements are called variances and whose off-diagonals are called covariances. Just to step through the way that the mean and the covariance matrix would be computed in this example, for this PDF that I wrote down before, the mean and the variance are easy to compute. If I add n of these guys together, then I would just put a factor of n here and a factor of n here. The central limit theorem is also true in n variables. So if I know that a distribution is Gaussianized and I can compute its mean and covariance, then I know the PDF, which is given by this expression involving the covariance matrix C. You might notice that the inverse covariance matrix appears in the PDF and that the square root of its determinant appears in the overall normalization. Those features will be important later. In this one variable example, if I want to understand what's happening as I increase n, what happens is that I evolve through some sequence of PDFs, which look different for different values of n, but their mean and covariance are behaving in a simple way. And then when n gets large and the central limit theorem takes over, then that mean and covariance fully determine the PDF. As I said a few slides ago, the elements on the diagonal of the covariance matrix are called variances, and their square roots are giving correspond to characteristic sizes of fluctuations in each component of the random variable. And the off diagonals just quantify the level of correlation between different components. So the correlation coefficient is always between minus 1 and 1, just defined by taking each off diagonal element and scaling by the square roots of the corresponding diagonals. That's the formal definition of correlation. Here's a little visual example, a two component example, where I took a multivariate Gaussian. And I left the diagonals elements of the covariance matrix the same. So these square roots of variances are the same. And I varied the off-diagonal element of the covariance matrix. And you can see that this is changing the shape of the ellipse, the level of correlation, keeping the overall extent in each axis the same. The CMB is a multivariate Gaussian random variable. So if I just step this example up from two variables to, say, 10 to the 7 variables to describe the CMB, I need to specify a temperature in each of 10 to the 7 pixels. Then if you wanted to make a simulation of the CMB sky on the computer, then you could make a perfect simulation, at least as far as the data tells you, In principle, this would not be a computationally efficient way to do it, but in principle, you could do it by computing the covariance matrix of every pair of pixels. That would be a 10 to the 7 by 10 to the 7 matrix. And drawing a multivariate random Gaussian from the draw a sample from the multivariate Gaussian distribution with that covariance matrix, a vector with 10 to the 7 components, and then you would read off the temperature in each of the pixels. It's helpful to have expressions for the behavior of the mean and the covariance under linear transformations. So if I have a random variable with n components, xi, and then I construct another random variable by multiplying by a matrix, this doesn't have to be a square matrix, so y can have, let's assume y has m components, then it's straightforward to work out how the mean and covariance matrix of y are related to the mean and covariance matrix of x. And you get the following transformation law. You just multiply the mean by a to get the mean of x by a to get the mean of y, which is intuitive. And for the covariance matrix, you multiply by a on one side and a transpose on the other. A theorem that I won't prove, but it's not hard to prove, is that if I apply a linear transformation to a random variable, and the original random variable were Gaussian, then the random variable AX is also a multivariate Gaussian. And in particular, the case where A is an invertible square matrix just corresponds to the case where you change variables or rotate the random variable to a different set of axes. And the Gaussian-ness of a random variable does not depend on the choice of bases.
Due to the Gaussian-nest?
Sorry?
The Gaussian-nest?
Gaussian-ness.
Oh, okay.
So if I say that a random variable with n components is a multivariate Gaussian, that statement doesn't depend on the basis in which I describe the random variable. But it would change the covariance matrix according to this rule. And so some problems involving random variables are just linear algebra problems in disguise. And it's useful to take your linear algebra toolkit and figure out how to translate it into the statistics context. Here's a fun problem to think about. How would you simulate on the computer a Gaussian random variable with a specified covariance matrix? If I give you, say, a 100 by 100 covariance matrix, how would you randomly sample a multivariate Gaussian random variable with that covariance matrix? Of course, there are software packages that would do that for you, but let's pretend that you don't have them, but you do know how to do the one-dimensional problem, sample a Gaussian random variable with, from the bell curve with 1 degree of freedom. There's actually more than one linear algebra trick that will answer this question, and I'll let you think about other answers, but here's one answer. If you imagine that, if you sort of think about this in a coordinate-free way, where I have some covariance matrix and I'm free to rotate it around to describe my Gaussian random variable in whatever basis is convenient, then one natural choice is to rotate to the basis where the covariance matrix is diagonal. So if I diagonalize C, find a rotation matrix R so that C is R times a diagonal matrix times R inverse. R is a rotation matrix, so its inverse is equal to its transpose. Simulate a Gaussian random variable with covariance matrix lambda. Now that's straightforward because if I have a Gaussian random variable with a diagonal covariance matrix, then that's just saying that each component of the random variable is an independent 1D Gaussian with the appropriate variance. Each lambda would be the sigma squared of the 1D Gaussian. And then rotate back, so call that y. And then rotate back to the original basis by defining x equals ry. So that works, and if you want to check that it works, you can just compute the covariance matrix of x according to our rule, and you get the original matrix C as desired. It's not a big step up in generality to just think about the case of a random field, which is a random variable in n components, where n is just the number of pixels that you need to describe the image. So this is an image with 256 squared pixels, and so I can think of it as a random variable with 256 squared components. The covariance matrix would be a matrix with 256 squared by 256 squared entries. I'm going to assume, by the way, from now on that the mean is zero for simplicity. That's true in the cosmological examples just by definition. For example, when we work with the CMB, even though the mean CMB temperature is 2.7 Kelvin, we just subtract that from the observed CMB map to get a delta T and always work with that. Okay. So a pixelized random field is no different from the situation that we've been talking about previously, a multivariate Gaussian random variable, just with a huge value of n. And if I take the continuum limit, I get a random field. So instead of this being some pixelized image with a pixel subscript, it's a continuous function of two vector x. The covariance matrix would be, in the pixelized case, a matrix with two indices, which are pixels. And that becomes a two-point correlation function, which is a function of two locations in the image. So this would, if there were no symmetry assumptions being made, then this two-point correlation function would be, I guess, a function of four variables. There are two components here and two variables here. Now, unless stated otherwise, when I say random field, I'm going to think about a situation where the symmetries that you would intuitively expect are assumed to hold. So in particular, for this 2D example of by the way, I'm assuming there's no bounding box, so this is an infinite image. So in particular, in these Euclidean examples, I'm going to assume that the statistics are translation and rotation invariant. So in particular, the two-point correlation function, I'm going to assume that by translation invariance, it only depends on the separation between the two points. And then by rotation invariance, that it doesn't depend on the, sometimes the separation between the two points is called the lag, by the way, I'll use that term. And by rotation invariance, it doesn't depend on the direction that that lag vector points in, it just depends on its length. So that the two-point correlation function, rather than being a function of 2D variables, where D is the number of dimensions, that, as it would be if there were no symmetries, is just a function of one variable, the scalar separation between the two points. And this function zeta is called the correlation function. All right. Here's a fundamental calculation, which will motivate the definition of the power spectrum. Suppose that I start with a random field in n Euclidean dimensions with some known correlation function zeta. And let me compute its two-point function in Fourier space. So I'm going to compute, instead of computing the expectation value between two f of x's, I'll take the Fourier transform and compute the two-point expectation value of two f of k's, with a star on one of the complex conjugate on one of the factors by definition. After a straightforward calculation, I find that this two-point correlation function always has a delta function in the wave number k. So two different wave numbers don't correlate. And the prefactor of the delta function is a function of k. It will only depend on the length of the wave number k, not its orientation, by rotational symmetry, which is defined to be the power spectrum p of k. So for a random field in n Euclidean dimensions, if there were no assumptions of symmetry, then the two-point function would, in both real space or Fourier space, be a function of two n variables. But with symmetry, with translation rotation symmetry, it's a function of one variable. And in real space, that's the correlation function between two points with some separation. In Fourier space, the two-point correlation function contains an n-dimensional delta function with a prefactor which just depends on the length of k, which is defined to be the power spectrum. Our calculation on the previous slide also showed that zeta and p are just related to each other by taking Fourier transforms. So This comes up all the time, and it's called the Wiener-Khinchin theorem, apparently, although I didn't know that until a couple years ago when I started teaching cosmology. The power spectrum and the correlation functions, you know, they contain equivalent information. They're just describing the same two-point function in either real space or Fourier space. And you can go back and forth by taking Fourier transforms. And these are n-dimensional Fourier transforms, but if I take the n-dimensional Fourier transform of a function of n variables which is spherically symmetric, then I get another function of n variables which is spherically symmetric, which is why it looks a little weird. They're functions of one variable that are related by an n-dimensional Fourier transform. Now, a random field is Gaussian. If its pixel values, if I think of it as a big vector with a huge number of components, are a multivariate Gaussian random variable in the usual sense. And because we showed that the Gaussian-ness of a random variable doesn't depend on which basis you write it in, this definition is equally good if I think about it in real space or in Fourier space. Generally speaking, it is true that a Gaussian random variable is completely determined, that the statistics are completely determined by the two-point function. So if I want to specify a Gaussian random variable, it's enough to specify either the correlation function zeta or the power spectrum p. It is often easiest to think about Gaussian random fields in Fourier space, since the covariance matrix is always diagonal. Earlier we talked about, so in Fourier space, each f of k is just an independent Gaussian random variable. A Gaussian random field is a super simple object where I just draw an independent Gaussian random number for each wave number k. Well, f of k is complex, so the real and imaginary parts are independent Gaussian. Earlier we talked about a situation where you might be simulating a Gaussian random variable, and you might diagonalize the covariance matrix to go to the basis where the covariance is diagonal. For a random field, the symmetry is, you wouldn't need to do that diagonalization explicitly. The Fourier basis is always the basis where the covariance is diagonal. I think of the Fourier transform as like a big rotation matrix that takes me from the collection of pixel values f of k, f of x, to the Fourier wave numbers f of k. Then that's always the rotation that diagonalizes the covariance. That follows from symmetry. One more comment is that this delta function on the right-hand side can be understood from translation invariance. If I just view the correlation function in a translated coordinate system, then the two-point function, this f of k picks up a factor of e to the ik dot a. This f of k star picks up a factor of e to the minus ik prime dot a. So the only way that the two-point function can be the same if viewed in a translated coordinate system is if this is only non-zero if when k minus k prime is zero. In other words, if there's a delta function appearing here on the right-hand side. Here are some plots of, now that we've defined a Gaussian random field, here are some plots of Gaussian random fields with power law power spectra, which came up earlier when I was talking about the standard model. One point that I want to emphasize here is that the code required to produce these plots is like 10 lines of code. There's no, you just simulate for each, you just loop over Fourier wave numbers in the plot. Populate each Fourier mode with some independent Gaussian random variables whose variance is taken by computed by evaluating the power spectrum. Then you've simulated the Gaussian random field in Fourier space, and then I just take the Fourier transform to make the plot in real space. L to the minus 2 is the scale invariant case, where if I took a small subregion of this plot and magnified it to the size of the original plot, it would be statistically indistinguishable from the original. In n dimensions, the scale invariant case is L to the minus n. I didn't state that on the slide. That's easy to show you by dimensional analysis, for example, or just by explicitly rescaling by a factor of lambda and working out what power spectrum you get.
How do you relate that to the fact that ns equals 1 was the thing that was scale invariant in three dimensions?
Oh, yeah, right. So. There were some conventions that I sort of swept under the rug when I was, so The power spectrum of zeta is usually written this way. First off, on the limit. So there'll be some explicit wave number here. Like. There's some historical ugliness in the way that the definitions are arranged here. So this is the formula that you'll see in all the textbooks. And so by convention, k cubed p zeta of k is appearing on the left-hand side. And there's also 2 pi squared here, which is just conventional. And so this definition is arranged so that the left-hand side is constant in k in the scale invariant case. Ns is defined with the minus 1 here, so that ns equals 1 would correspond to the scale invariant case. And the observed value is 0.965. One unfortunate thing about astronomy seems to be that it never deletes its weird historical terminology. For example, brightnesses of astrophysical objects are quoted in magnitudes, which is the terminology that goes back to the ancient Greeks, rather than some modern, you know, unit like energy per square meter collecting area. Okay. Let me just remind you, so I also wanted to say, so this is a scale invariant Gaussian random field. And if the power spectrum is a power law where the exponent is not minus 2 or minus the number of dimensions, then I have the situation where the random field is self-similar but not scale invariant. So this is, in this plot, the power spectrum is red, meaning that there's more power on large scales than small scales. And you could, and this one, there's more power on small scales. And you could see that visually in the plots. Let me just remind you that when I plot random fields, I very often in cosmology, random fields are Gaussian. And so the power spectrum contains all the information. There's no information in these plots that isn't in the power spectrum when I write it down. At late times in cosmology, this is not true at all. Here's a visual example. Here's the cosmological density field coming out of an n-body simulation. And here is a Gaussian field with the same power spectrum. So for a CMB, for a CMB realization, the two plots would look indistinguishable from each other. The CMB is a Gaussian field. But after nonlinear evolution has taken place, there's all of this structure that you see here, the voids and the filaments and the hot spots where matter has collapsed into halos, is non-Gaussian structure that wouldn't be captured in the power spectrum. The simplest example of a Gaussian random field is white noise, where in real space, each pixel value is independent. Or another way of saying it is that the correlation function is a delta function. It's less awkward to write down if I write the correlation function as a function of the vector lag and put an n-dimensional vector function on the right-hand side. In this case, the covariance matrix would be diagonal in both real space and in Fourier space. The power spectrum of white noise is constant in K. And this follows from the statement that the power spectrum and correlation function are Fourier transforms. If I Fourier transform a delta function, I get a constant. Now, a linear operator applied to a Gaussian random field gives another Gaussian random field. That's just a special case of the statement that we made before, that if I take a Gaussian random variable in n dimensions and multiply it by an m by n matrix, I get a Gaussian random variable in m dimensions. This is a powerful statement. So for example, let me try to compute the power spectrum of a one-dimensional Gaussian random walk. Here's a Gaussian random walk I made on the computer. I just took a sequence of Gaussian random variables and I just added at each time step of the plot a Gaussian random variable to the previous accumulated sum. Here's a nice way to compute the power spectrum of a Gaussian random walk. You might observe that the random walk is the integral of white noise. We saw before that the power spectrum of white noise was a constant. And so if I get the random walk by starting with a white noise realization and taking an integral, then in Fourier space, taking the integral will just multiply each Fourier mode by 1 over I omega. And remember that the power spectrum is the expectation value of FF star. So the power spectrum would get multiplied by 1 over I omega times 1 over minus I omega, or 1 over omega squared. So the power spectrum of this random walk is just 1 over omega squared. And it's one of the self-similar cases that I showed before in 2D. So here's another example of applying a linear operator to a Gaussian random field to get another Gaussian random field, which is really representative of what happens, say, in the CMB. And in this case, the linear operator is going to be a time evolution operator with some physics in it. So I want to think about a field which is a function of space and some number of time and some number of spatial coordinates. And I'm going to assume that it evolves in time via the wave equation, where the parameter CS is a sound speed or fluctuation. To specify the problem fully, let me assume that at time 0, I have the following initial conditions. The first derivative of f is going to be 0 in the initial conditions. I'm just going to decide to assume that. And I'm going to assume that if I take a snapshot at time 0, that spatial field configuration is a Gaussian random field with some known initial power spectrum P0. Then I'll ask the question, if I evolve that initial snapshot, that initial Gaussian random snapshot, to some later time, take another snapshot, what is its spatial power spectrum? So to answer this question, I'm going to Fourier transform the wave equation in the spatial direction, but I'm not going to take a Fourier transform in time. The wave equation looks like this. The second time derivative just looks like k squared times the Fourier mode. So then the solution is, after taking that Fourier transform, the different k modes decouple. The solution to the wave equation is easy to write down. I just apply this sinusoidal factor to the Fourier mode at time 0. In analogy to the previous example, where I was taking an antiderivative, which just multiplied each Fourier mode by some factor, 1 over I omega, here all the evolution is doing is it's just multiplying each Fourier mode by some factor. And so if I take a snapshot at some later time and take its power spectrum, I'll get the square of that factor. So what's happened in this example is that the physics has imprinted oscillations on the power spectrum. If I started with a featureless power spectrum, like one of the power law examples, in the initial conditions, and then observed the power spectrum at a later time, then I would see sinusoidal ripples. I would get some parameter sensitivity. If I know capital T, for example, then I could infer CS. That's what's happening in the CMB. But the evolution is a lot more complicated. I've started with an initial power spectrum of the, in the initial conditions, the power spectrum is just this featureless power law. Then when I compute the CMB, I'm looking at a snapshot after some physical evolution is taking place. It's imprinted all of this interesting physics on the power spectrum. Like there's an acoustic scale here. Which is related to a sound speed. This acoustic scale turns out to be related to the total distance that a sound wave travels in the plasma between the Big Bang and the era when the CMB is formed. That depends on the cosmological parameters, so you can use this information to constrain cosmological parameters. The physics of...
What's on the Y scale here? Because it's the third time of this plot, I'm kind of missing the Sachs-Wolfe thing.
You're asking about Sachs-Wolfe?
The Sachs-Wolfe plateau.
So that would be, if you know about the Sachs-Wolfe effect, then so at very...
It's because the plots are always in the log scale at low L's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still should be up to 50, right, in L.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. This is so. There is a Sachs-Wolfe plateau where the power spectrum is roughly constant, but it's at very low L. It's all squeezed into like this.
Yeah. Okay.
So since you were stopped, what are you plotting?
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of so for 3D power spectra, 3D power spectra are often quoted as this parameter combination. And analogously in the CMB, the thing that's often plotted is L times L plus 1 times CL over 2 pi. So this parameter combination would be constant if the CMB were a scale invariant random field. The plus 1 has to do with the fact that the CMB is defined on the spherical sky rather than Euclidean.
So you're taking the power spectrum, you're expanding it into spherical harmonics, and you're taking the Cs as the coefficients. That's what you plot.
That's right, yeah. I'll talk about spherical harmonics in a minute. One complication is that, you know, I've presented this plot as if the CMB were a Gaussian random field on a Euclidean, you know, plane, but it's really defined on the sphere, so I'll talk about that in a minute. Just to give, of course, the physics is much more complicated. Just to convey a sense for how much, you know, in this example, solving the differential equation, you know, was analytically possible, and it was also a one-liner. To give a sense for how complicated the physics is that goes from here to here, the numerical software packages that do that integration are on the order of like 100,000 lines of code. There are many species that are important, and the differential equations are just really messy. The messiest part is actually the atomic physics at the end of CMB formation. The process by which the protons and electrons combine to form neutral hydrogen is a very complicated process with, you know, couplings between different energy of many different energy levels of the hydrogen atom playing a role. Oh yeah, another, you know, just little thing I want to mention is that just like in the non-field case, the case where I was forming a Gaussian random variable by applying an M by N matrix to another Gaussian random variable, it didn't matter whether the number of components here was the same as the number of components here. The matrix could have been an M by N rectangular matrix. And likewise, it doesn't really matter in this example that the CMB is defined in a different number of dimensions in the curvature perturbation zeta. The operator that goes from here to here, you know, is an operator that takes a random field in 3 Euclidean dimensions and produces a random field in 2 spherical dimensions. But that doesn't matter. It's still a Gaussian random field. Okay. So one final technical detail. So far, our fields have been defined on Euclidean space. So for example, I've been implicitly describing the CMB in the so-called flat sky approximation, which is actually a very reasonable thing to do if you're a data analyst that's analyzing a CMB experiment that only measures, say, a few square degrees of sky. It would be reasonable to treat that, ignore the spherical curvature, and do everything with Fourier transforms. But on the full sky, say, the CMB is, you know, a function on the unit sphere. We just need to talk about the analog of the Fourier transform for the sphere. And that's, of course, the spherical harmonic transform. So in Euclidean space, any field f of x, any real space field, can be represented as a linear combination of plane waves into the ikx. And analogously on the sphere, any field, any function of theta and phi, is a linear combination of spherical harmonics YLM. So those are, I'm sure you've seen in some context. The spherical harmonic YLM is a special function which is defined for integers. So the quantization of the wave numbers is related to the compactness of the sphere, and it's the same quantization that happens in quantum mechanics where angular momentum is quantized. So the spherical harmonic YLM is a special function defined for integer L and integer m between minus L and L. The counting, the only properties, I've plotted a few just for fun, a few of these spherical harmonics just for fun. The L is intuitively interpreted as like an angular wave number, like L equals 1 is a dipole mode, and L equals 2 is a quadrupole mode. The only properties of the spherical harmonics that I'll really use in the subsequent slide are just the way the mode counting works. So for each L, there are 2 L plus 1 independent orthogonal spherical harmonics. So any function is represented is representable. Any function on the sphere is representable as a linear combination of spherical harmonics, as a sum with some coefficients, ALM. And that's the analog of the Fourier transform for the sphere. And in a Euclidean space, I would start with some real space field f of x, and its Fourier transform would be a function f of k of the wave number. On the sphere, the way it works is that if I start with some real space field defined on the sphere, then its Fourier transform is just this set of coefficients, ALM, discrete sequence of coefficients. And so you could start building up a dictionary between where you translate things between the Euclidean and the spherical case. And this dictionary is longer and more complicated than you might think. Like, for example, the analog of convolution in the Euclidean case is in the spherical case is some messy sum that involves three Clebsch-Gordan coefficients or Wigner 3J symbols. But just to put in what might be the first five lines in the dictionary, the real space representation of a field is, in the spherical case, some function of two angular variables, theta and phi. The analog of a Fourier space field is just some sequence of coefficients ALM defined for non-negative integer L and an integer M between minus L and L. The analog of the Fourier transform, which takes me from the Fourier space representation of a field to its real space representation, would just be this sum. If I have some set of ALMs, then I just do this sum, and I get the real space pixel values of the field. And if you do data-oriented cosmology, there are software packages with fancy algorithms for doing this sum efficiently. You can pass in some sequence of ALMs, and it gives you the pixel values in some nice pixelization. That's how I made all the CMB maps that I showed before. It's by simulating the field in Fourier space, and then as you would do, because the covariance matrix is diagonal, and then taking the spherical transform to plot the real space field. The inverse transform, if you consider the inverse transform, where you start with the real space representation of a field and compute its Fourier space representation, then this is sort of a genuine difference between the Euclidean and spherical cases. In the Euclidean case, the inverse Fourier transform has essentially the same algebraic form as the forward Fourier transform. And in the spherical case, they are a little different. The way that you take the inverse, if I view this sum as a transform that takes me from ALMs to F, then the way the inverse transform would work is that you start with F, and because the spherical harmonics are orthonormal functions on the sphere, if I multiply by YLM star and integrate, then I just keep one of the terms in this expansion, the remaining terms go to zero. So the way that I would do the inverse transform is I would start with my function in real space, multiply the function by YLM star and integrate, and that gives me each ALM. I would do that integral. The way that it's written, it looks like I have to do a whole integral from scratch for each LM pair, but on the computer, there are fast algorithms that do things more cleverly and can do this inverse transform very quickly. And then finally, the statement that will come up a lot in the subsequent lectures is just the definition of the power spectrum, the way that it works. So in the Euclidean case, we saw that the two-point function in Fourier space had this functional form with the n-dimensional delta function and a coefficient p of k that depended on the magnitude of k, but not its direction. And the analog of that statement for the spherical field, which as in the Euclidean case, has symmetry assumptions. Like the symmetry assumptions that I'm making in the spherical case is that I have a random field which is invariant under the full group of rotations of the sphere, that three parameter family of rotations. Under that symmetry assumption, it can be shown, and this is not trivial at all, and I won't try to give a proof in the slides, that the two-point function in Fourier space has two Kronecker deltas on the right-hand side, just like this formula would have in the two-dimensional case has two delta functions. So ALM correlates with itself, but not any other multipole AL prime M prime. And the coefficient here depends on L but not M. just like in the Euclidean case, P of k depended on the magnitude of k, but not its orientation. This functional form on the right-hand side, but you've seen this if you've done the Wigner-Eckhart theorem in quantum mechanics, that says that a rotationally invariant Hamiltonian, say, can only couple a state with rotational wave numbers Lm to another state with rotational wave numbers Lm with some coefficient that's independent of m. Same proof. This functional form follows from symmetry and is also the definition of the power spectrum CL. All the C and B power spectra that I showed before, what I was really plotting was the power spectrum CL that's defined this way. By the way, the power spectrum, you know, strictly speaking, in the spherical case, the power spectrum CL is only defined for integer values of L, even though, of course, when you make a plot on the computer, it connects all the points by one. This may be my last slide. Let's see. Yep. I finished a little early, but it's hard to lecture for 90 minutes. Tomorrow I'm gonna. Today I just talked about some like random field machinery, just so that we have all the terminology and concepts, like definition of the power spectrum. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about. I decided to give a lecture on forecasting in the Fisher matrix. I'll tell you what the Fisher matrix is tomorrow. Thanks.